It's okay. I'll just keep going.
Thanks for your patience, Jennifer.
No problem. So yeah. Now I can't see my notes, but that's okay. So I didn't feel like I was part of Treaty 7. So Crystal said to me, you know what you should do? And this is something interesting that you can do as well with your students, is to look up where you are from and who are the Indigenous people that that are from where you are from. So I'm from Quebec, which is right beside your province, in Abitibi-Témiscamingue. I don't know if you know where that is. It's very close to North Bay, Sudbury, so close to you guys. And it is where the first Indigenous people that lived there were called the Algonquin. The Algonquin are actually people that live, that were used to living in the forest in very cold weather. Like when I lived in Abitibi-Témiscamingue, there's tons of snow. It's freezing cold. And so when the white colonizers came to this area, actually the Algonquin helped them to be able to, you know, start building their community in that area by teaching them about the forest, how to live in the cold, and what plants to use for medicine. So then this made me feel more connected to Indigenous people by learning about the Indigenous people of where I was from. And I think it's a really fun activity that you can do with your students as well. So I just want to share that with you as well. So you're probably wondering, who is this Jennifer Russo? Why was she invited? Maybe you've heard, because Jennifer came to see one of my previous presentations to Eyed Seeing, which I presented with my friend Bruce McKay. But I wanted to introduce myself to you today with the lens of UDL. So one of the things about me is that I'm an English language learner. I told you before that I was born in Quebec. I was born to French parents that didn't speak any English at all. I only spoke French at home. My grandparents were French. All our friends were French. And the reason I got to English school, because actually in Quebec, there's some laws that saying you're not allowed to go to English school if your parents aren't English, is that I did get to move to North Bay for a little bit because my father was in the military. So as a student, this was kind of difficult. I had to learn English. There was nobody to help me at home. I didn't speak the language at all when I was in school. I have memories of the very first day. Like, I started English school in kindergarten. I have very first memories of the first day I understood something, and it was in grade 2. So that's a long time of just going to school and hearing blah, 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 blah. And then also my father, because he was in the military, was often gone. So I was just there with my mom and my siblings, and I felt pretty alone. I also suffered from chronic illness. I have chronic osteomyelitis, which happened when I broke my arm when I was in grade 2. I got a bone infection, which infected my other bones. So I had to miss tons of school. I missed most of grade 4, most of grade 5. And I was in pain and on medication most of the time that I was in school. I was from a low income bracket. My mother didn't work and my father was just a corporal in the army. So we didn't have a lot of money and we lived for a while in a mobile home. And I'm a first generation learner. My parents never went to post-secondary. Even when I was a child, my parents hadn't finished high school, but they really want me to tell you that they did finish high school later on, because my dad did finish his high school in his 40s. And he thought that was really important that I tell people that, which it is, it's a celebration. Of course, he took a lot of courses with the Army, and my mother, she followed a technical route and she became a seamstress. So then as an adult, I also married a military person. So I was often by myself. I had 2 children and it was difficult, which led to my divorce, which was very stressful. All this time I was working. I was a single parent. And when my son turned 4, we found out that actually he had autism. So then I joined the neurodiverse community. And my son is an amazing person. He's doing so well, and he teaches me so much and has helped me so much with my job. But when he was little and we found out he had autism, I had to miss tons of work because he had to go to speech therapy. He had to go to occupational therapy, and he had to go to many, many appointments. And then I decided to do my master's as I was working. So I was an online student doing all my work at night and on the weekend while I was being a single parent of a neurodiverse child. So all this was going on in my life. And I just wanted to introduce myself this way, because many of our students have all these barriers, which are really not medical barriers, except for my chronic illness. They're just life barriers that happen. And still, I'm here today presenting to you with my master's in post-secondary, and that's amazing. But the reason that I am here doing that is because of all the amazing teachers that were flexible with me, that gave me extensions, that allowed me to work from home in the evenings and used UDL. So I just wanted to show you this picture. This is me in the blue pants and my sister living in North Bay in our mobile home. And that's my grandma who used to take care of us in the summer while my parents were working, or my mom, my dad was working and my mom needed a break. Thanks for the heart. So just to keep in mind that there's a lot of barriers in our student lives, and you wouldn't even know. When I introduce Universal Design for Learning, I really like to use this comic. This is one of my favorite things. I always say Universal Design is about eliminating barriers to enhance student success. So here we have a little crocodile, and he's in a hot air balloon. And he says, "Come join me, Peter." And then Peter is a giraffe, and he has a really long neck. And he says, "I'd love to, but I think I'm too tall." So then the crocodile says, "No worries, I have another hot air balloon." And he changes the environment, right? He changes the hot air balloon so that Peter can come in. So I always say Universal Design for Learning is about changing the environment to eliminate barriers to enhance student success. So everybody gets to go on this great hot air balloon together, this hot air balloon trip together, versus going by themselves, which would be no fun. But maybe if you've already studied Universal Design for Learning, you're more used to this representation of what it is. So Universal Design for Learning was invented by CAST back in the 80s. If you haven't visited their website yet, I highly suggest you do. So it's CAST.org. And it's a flexible framework with three pillars. The first pillar here is green, the why of learning, engagement. So we want to engage our students, get them excited about learning. The what of learning is the purple in the middle. Representation, how we present our content to students. And the how of learning is the blue, action and expression, how we assess our students. So when we talk about UDL, we always start with the why. The why is really important. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? So because today you are my students, I'm going to start with the why. Why use UDL at all? And why is it important to humanize what we're doing, to build relationships with students, and also to manage our workload? So back in 2020, I don't know if you read this, there was this white paper that came out, and it was called Meeting the Needs of Adult Learners. And it was published by the Chronicle of Higher Education. It's actually a US paper. A lot of the information that I get about UDL did come from the US just because this is where CAST is. But a lot of the statistics, I later checked them with Canada, are very similar. So what this white paper said is that post-secondary institutions had disconnected priorities with their students. What are those priorities? Well, first of all, post-secondary institutions were still kind of teaching the 9 to 5. That was the preference, right? Teaching during the day. When this is a problem because many of our students have jobs during the day and actually would rather study at night or on the weekends, which was my situation when I was doing my master's. Also said that a lot of post-secondary institutions prefer teaching face-to-face to the traditional student that can come to class. And we know that not all students can come to class for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they have childcare issues, sometimes they have mobility issues, sometimes they have transportation issues. And also that post-secondary institutions were kind of still leaving online students behind and thinking of them as an afterthought and, you know, not prioritizing them. So this is what it told us, and these are problems that we need to fix. Another reason why we want to use UDL is related to the Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 Sustainable Development Goals. I don't know if you've heard about them. You can learn a lot about them on YouTube. You can go to their website, which I wrote down here. You can just Google 17 Sustainable Development Goals. These are goals that were created by the UN and that Canada has actually agreed to meet by the end of 2030. And a lot of post-secondary institutions are actually committing to signing a document committing to achieve these goals. And the goals that are important to us and that relate to UDL are the following four. So the first one is quality education for all. Like I told you before, we want to create quality education for our students that are traditional, that are there face-to-face, but also for our students that can't come face-to-face and that are online, that need to study at night or in the evenings, at night, evenings, and weekends. Gender equality, number 5. So we really want to make sure that there are no barriers for women in our post-secondary institutions, even though we know women usually, as I had to, have to carry that work, extra workload of taking care of the children, and often have, they can have issues with childcare, either paying for childcare, finding childcare, reliable childcare. So we want to make sure that we eliminate those barriers so that women can continue their studies and don't have to put them on hold just because they're a parent as well. 8, decent work and economic growth for all. So we want everybody to be able to have a good job, a reliable job, and a well-paying job. But often to get to a well-paying job, often you have to go to post-secondary institution. And often the barriers are in post-secondary institutions. So our people can't get out of post-secondary to get to those great jobs. So we want to eliminate those barriers that are in our schools so they can get to those great jobs and reduce inequalities. So we have all sorts of people that come to our institutions. Some have physical disabilities. Some people have learning disabilities. Some people have mental health diagnosis where sometimes they can't come to the building. Right? So again, we want to reduce inequalities by making sure that we create a situation where everybody can continue their studies and move on to those decent work and those great jobs. Okay, so now I told you the why. You know all the why. You're like, okay, thanks for telling us that, Jennifer. What's the next slide? How can we change, right? How can we change? So at Bow Valley College, we say, let's challenge our thinking. I love this picture. It's a little lizard and there's a rabbit and he's holding a bag of carrots and the carrots have fallen all over the ground. And the lizard says, what happened? And the rabbit says, my bag broke. And so the lizard opens up his neck like an umbrella and carries the carrots. The reason I love this picture is because it reminds us that how can we challenge our thinking? Well, we need to have a growth mindset. We need to be creative. as this lizard is. And we also need to be brave. In Ontario, my understanding is that you guys actually have some legislation now that says you have to use UDL at, in Alberta, we still do not, but at Bow Valley College, we have a mission. So at least my work is guided by this mission, and the mission says to include all learners, to challenge our thinking, to remove barriers, to provide opportunity, to make all learning count. And this is our mission that we follow when we're teaching class, and we ask ourselves, how are we going to engage our students? How are we going to present content to our students? And how are we going to assess our students? Okay, I promise I'm coming with the real solutions. I just wanted to say, so CAS.org, again, I go to all their presentations. Please go to their website. Some of them you have to pay for, some of them are free. But one of the people that work there is Luis Perez. He's up here in the corner. And Luis Perez is a super cool person. I meet with him almost monthly during the year. He is also ELL. He comes from an immigrant family, and he also has a visual disability. And he says the first thing that you want to do when you're thinking about using UDL and you want to humanize learning is to start the design thinking process always starts with empathy. He always says, lean left, start with empathy. He's the one that taught me about alt text, which I showed you at the beginning, how to right click on your pictures and to say what your pictures say, because he actually has this visual disability and he uses that text to speech all the time, the screen reader, and he couldn't read my images. So he was being left behind because of me. I had created this barrier by using so many pictures, and he taught me how to fix that problem and reminds me all the time, start with empathy. So I wanted to remind you that as well. So what's one, some things that we can do to help our students to humanize the process and also to reduce our workload? So one of the things I always do is I like to record my classes. If I have an online class, obviously that's easy. I think this presentation is being recorded. I think most of us know how to do that. But even in my traditional class, when I'm teaching, I like to bring my laptop. And I could do two things. We're lucky we have a modern classroom, so we do have cameras where I can record my class this way. But if I don't, some classrooms don't, I'll try to do a poor man's modern classroom, which I'll just bring my laptop and record my class. If I really can't do that after my class, I like, sometimes I'll try to create a very small lecture, maybe of 20 minutes, and add that to D2L so that students can see my face. We can have this human, you know, relationship. I'm talking to them on camera. What I workload wise, I think that students, when they're absent or they miss class or they were late, they don't have to come to me to ask questions. All they have to do is go watch the recording. Some people have said, you know, to me, well, students won't come to class if they know there's a recording. I just think that that's not the right way to think about it. Like I told you before, I was a master's student studying at Memorial University. There's a 3.5 hour time change. Sometimes my teacher had class. I think it was at 7:30 at night, which was 3:30 for me in Calgary. So I was teaching. I wasn't able to go to any of those. I watched all the recordings. I was still very engaged. I felt connected to my teacher. So we can't assume because people don't come to class that they're not engaged. And we have to believe in the process that, yes, they're going to go watch that recording and it's going to benefit them. And sometimes teachers will tell me, well, I checked the number of views for the recording. There was only one. Well, good. That's one person that benefited from the recording, right? That's, we can't look at it at how many people have gone to see it. Another thing that I would encourage you to do is something called transparent design. And here you have a cup that says it's on the syllabus. So many of us probably have a syllabus that is very boring, that says, you know, when the assignments are, and that's important, and what dates that they're due. But I think it's really important to add your UDL policy to the syllabus. And I've been to a lot of CAS presentations that encourage this. Try to humanize that syllabus. Try to show a little bit of your personality on there and explain to students the why. Remember, that's how we engage them, is starting with the why. Why am I doing this? Why do I want you to hand in assignments on time? Or why do I give in extensions? Or why do I allow students to walk around the class? Or why do I record all my classes and let you watch them repeatedly again? Actually, maybe you came to class, but you want to watch them again, and this is going to help you with your learning. So often students don't know why we do things, and it's important to include that why in your syllabus and try to humanize that document. So when students read it, they feel, wow, my teacher really thought about this and made all these decisions because they care about my learning and they're trying to eliminate barriers. They want to enhance my experience. Another thing you can do is create professional learning communities. Now, this idea does not come from me. It comes from one of the teachers that attends my community of practice, and I just thought it was amazing. So one of the problems we had at Bow Valley College is a lot of the students told us they were lonely, that they had no friends, that they felt isolated. They didn't feel like they belonged to the community. And this is something that one of my instructors thought about for a long time. She was really heartbroken by it. So she decided to create professional learning communities, which is really groups of four in her class. So on the very first day of class, what she does is put all her students in groups of four. That means that all her students are automatically going to have three friends, three colleagues, three people that they can talk to. And she actually forces them to meet once a week. They have to meet once a week for 1 hour on MS Teams. She asks them to record this meeting. She doesn't attend the meeting unless they invite her, they ask her to. And she doesn't watch the recordings unless she's told that there was a problem. But she does this just for accountability to make sure that the students are meeting. And she has had such positive feedback from this. The students all said now they at least had three friends. During their meetings, they can discuss the assignment. They can discuss what's going on in class. They can discuss their personal problems, barriers that they have, and solutions maybe to these problems. She did share a personal story, for example, of one student that was having maybe some mental health issues and didn't know what to do. And then another student told this student how they had been to counseling at Bow Valley College because it's free and it's included in her student fees. And the other student, even though she had been told this at, you know, orientation, sometimes when it's coming from a peer, it just feels, you know, more natural, and decided, yeah, maybe I will go to counseling as well. So it's amazing what these professional learning communities can do. Also, some feedback that she got, because she's in early childhood education, is that some of these students have remained in their professional learning communities after they left Bow Valley College while they were at work. And now they have a real professional learning community, even though they work at different places, they still meet every week and they talk about how to solve problems and brainstorm new ideas for their job. So I just think this is so amazing and it creates great community. Another thing that we can do, change when we assess. I know that we have assignments and that's when we assess, but maybe you've noticed sometimes that students do really well in class when we're practicing, when we're doing some practice assessment, and then they answer all the right questions, you know, they understand what they're doing. And then when it comes to the assignment, maybe something happens and they bomb it. I think it's important to assess all the time. At Bow Valley College, we're really pushing competency-based education, which means when a student achieves an outcome, it doesn't necessarily have to be at the assessment. It can be at any time during the semester. So something that, and I know that this is difficult and there might be some policy at your school. It might be a gray area about if you can do this, but again, let's challenge our thinking. Do we have to assess only at the assignment or can we assess all the time? If we saw somebody achieve the outcomes that they needed to achieve at another time during the semester, but they didn't do well on one assignment, what can we do to rectify that? And how can we still give them, how can we still give them credit for achieving the outcome, even if it wasn't during one specific assignment? It's really challenging your thinking, right? So back to this workload part, I wanted to remind you, you're not a robot. There's two robots in this picture. One robot is brand new. The other robot might feel like how you felt at the end of the last semester, a little broken up. Just remember, you're not a robot. And even though I told you, you can assess all the time, you don't need to assess everything either. There's this book, and I don't know if you've ever heard of this lady, and she's amazing, and I really recommend you look her up. But it's called Ungrading: Why Rating Students Undermines Learning and What to Do Instead by Susan D. Bloom. And so she talks about how we don't have to assess everything. Something that I used to do when I was teaching, for example, is ask my students to share work on Thursday. I would totally ask for volunteers. I used to teach literature, so my students would write essays about books, and the assignments would be due Sunday, the essay, but I would ask them to share on Thursday. And it would be totally volunteer. And some people would share, and even though this was, you know, totally volunteer, and it was just for practice, and they would achieve the outcome. So I would be like, okay, you got perfect. You don't even need to hand in an assignment anymore. I already know you did well. Some other people would share the work and they didn't do so well, but I wasn't marking it. I would just give it some feedback in class with everybody around so that everybody could see, okay, this person did this well, this person did this mistake. I'm not going to make that mistake. I might do something similar to what that person did. But I didn't have to grade everything. I didn't have to give a grade for everyone's practice. And then I didn't have to give a grade for everyone's assignment if I felt like they had already achieved the outcome in the practice. I hope that makes sense. So again, really challenging our thinking about when we assess. Allow for extensions. So one thing that I do is I allow for extensions all the time. I do this for many reasons. The first reason that I do this is I was really tired of being the morality police. You know, I don't need you to come and tell me a story and then I have to decide if that story is true or not true, who gets an extension and who doesn't. So I just tell my students, I write it in the syllabus and I say part is universal design for learning as I give my students extensions all the time. The answer will always be yes, and you can have as long as you need. Of course, I explain to my students, you know, the danger of extensions. Sure, you can have extensions for everything, but if you don't commit to completing something, there is going to be a danger that you're going to fail. Another reason why I allow for extensions really improved, and a lot of instructors at Bow Valley College have started to follow me, the quality of the work that I received. So instead of handing in something because it's not quite ready, but I have to, students were really able to perfectionalize their work. I don't know if that's a word. And then also reduce academic dishonesty, right? Some students get so stressed about meeting the deadline and they're not finished. So they're like, okay, I'm going to plagiarize something and hand it in. But as soon as I started to allow for extensions, the number of plagiarized assignments I got was reduced almost to zero because students didn't have to do that anymore. You know, there's research that says students plagiarize because of fear of being, you know, ridiculed by their peers, fear of looking bad in front of their instructor. and even fear of disappointing their family, which is ironic because you'd think that by plagiarizing, they would disappoint their family, but they tend to think that the opposite, that this is a solution. So that's another reason why I give extensions for all assignments. And I write it in my syllabus. Some instructors have told me, you know, Jennifer, I don't feel comfortable doing this. And I just, I'm worried about my workload in the future. So what they've done is instead used tokens. So they might tell students, so there's several ways you can do this. Maybe you have two chances where you can have extensions, or one chance where you can have extensions. So not every assignment, but maybe just two or one. Something else that my grad teacher used to do is if we had seven assignments, for example, she would say you only need to do five. So as a student, I have the agency, the choice to choose what are the two assignments I'm not going to do. And probably I'm going to choose those depending on what's going on in my life and my workload at home, right? So if I knew that one week was going to be very busy at work and with my kids, maybe that's the assignment I'm not going to complete. So again, really explaining the why in your syllabus is going to help you with trying this out. I really hope you try it out. It's been a game changer for me, because then I don't get all those emails like, oh, I can't get this in for this and that reason. Another thing I would encourage you to do, we talk about presenting content in different ways. That's the purple, the blue part of the UDL, the middle part anyway, I can't remember if it's blue or purple now, is to record your instructions. Now, if you're super brave like me, so when you have an assignment, you write down the instructions. Most of us do that. And a whole bunch of students write us and say, well, I didn't understand. I don't understand this part. I don't understand that part. And that impacts your workload, right? When you're answering all these questions. And often in class, you spend, you know, a whole class explaining the assignment. And some people weren't there. And then they call you and they're like, but I forget, you know, I don't know what you said. Can you please explain it to me again? So please continue to write your written instructions for an assignment, but if you can, and this is D2L, so if you use D2L, this is accessible to you quite easily, record your instructions as well. If you're brave like me, you're going to use the video. If you don't want to be on camera, you can use the audio, which is just as good. You're really humanizing the process because now the student can hear your voice. You can add your comments. Don't read what's on the document. I mean, they could use a screen reader to that. This is where you really add your personality, what you would have said in class to explain the assignment, maybe clarify certain parts. Often when I read an assignment, I will tell mistakes people did in the past. You know, in the past, people interpreted this part as doing this, but please don't do that. Do this instead. This is what I meant by this. This is what I mean by this part. So this can really reduce your workload because students can go back and listen to it many times. And again, they hear your tone and they get all your personality. So they feel like they're connected to you. Another thing that I highly suggest when you are giving out assignments is to have examples of previous assignments. You have it up here, examples of previous assignments. Don't just have one example. The problem with that when you only have one is that all your students are going to try to copy the format of that one, and it doesn't really leave room for authentic assessment or creativity. So I always try to give as many examples as I can. Every year when I give an assignment and students do well, I ask them, can I keep your assignment and use it to show as an example to other students? I might use it, I might not, but I always make a bank. I always make a bank and keep as many assignments as I can. So then for every assignment, I might share five or six, and I rotate them sometimes to show different varieties of what's possible for this assignment and really show students how they can, you know, think outside the box. Another thing you can do when you submit your assignments is, again, to include, you know, your late coursework submission, all that stuff that you have on the syllabus. Sometimes you can recap it just to remind students what your policy is about late assignments. You know, are you giving extensions? Are they using a token system? Is it you only have to do 5 out of 7? But try to be as clear as possible when we tell and explain why, right? Sometimes, like I said, I give extensions all the time. Some teachers didn't, but they explain why, because of the workload issue. They might say, you know, there's 100 students in this class. I can't accept late assignments after a certain date, or maybe if I accept it after this date, that's not what we're going to be learning anymore, and I don't think it's going to benefit your learning. But really giving that why you have to hand in an assignment by a certain time will really make students, you know, respect your policy more. Going back to that reduced workload, right? Use rubrics. Are you using rubrics already? Many of us are. What are the benefits of rubrics? They minimize miscommunication. They create focused work, because students can, it's really important that you give that rubric before students hand in the assignment. Students can look at that rubric, and often a lot of the teachers I work with ask the students to mark themselves before they hand in their work using the rubric. And maybe even to give rationale. And they sometimes have to hand in this rubric. So it really shows them, okay, did I do this part? Did I do this part? Often our students won't look at the rubric. So forcing them to mark themselves and hand it in with their work is an interesting way to make them accountable. It makes your grading consistent. And of course, it saves time. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't give students feedback. This is all about humanizing learning. So yes, you should give them feedback. I use a rubric to, you know, evaluate outcomes. And then I use feedback, written or oral, to reward effort. Because effort is the behavior I want repeated. So I'll show you some of the feedback that I give to my students. At first, I wasn't using a lot of technology. I wasn't using a lot of video like I've been recommending to you. So instead, what I was doing is, before students even handed in an assignment, I would sit down by myself, open up a Word document, and think of everything positive I could say to somebody who had completed this assignment. So I would write things like, "Congratulations on completing your second assignment. It's not easy to be a student. You have plenty of responsibilities that need your attention, but I'm glad you decide to prioritize your education. This class has 4 assignments, so you have now completed half the course." I'm trying to show them the glass is half full here. Look at what you've done. And I would say things like, "You were able to do this. You were able to do that." This is all my Word document, so I can copy and paste it for every student, which would take me, you know, if I have 50 students, I can't write these long one page to every student, but now I'm copy and pasting. And if something comes up where I need to edit, it's pretty easy to do. So for example, when somebody wasn't able to do something, instead of saying "you were able to," I might say, you tried to write your own thesis. And I would just change it back to, "you tried to do this. You just need a little more practice. But don't give up. This skill will serve you for the rest of your life, and you will continue to get better at it." This I stole from dialectical behavioral therapy strategies, right? Putting positive feedback into people's heads really reinforces their will, their effort to try, and it makes them, you know, it just makes students happy. It gives them confidence. It builds relationship. When I started doing this, I started getting lots of emails from students that were positive. I used to get emails from students that were like, "Where's my assignment? You didn't mark it." But now I started getting emails that were like, "No one ever told me that I could be a writer," or "No one ever told me that I could do this well." It was actually heartbreaking, because I never thought that just giving positive reinforcement in writing in this copy and paste format could help students, but it did. And I did student marks actually get better. I would often say things as well, like other students that struggle with writing papers have told me, the Writing Center is an excellent resource. Here's the link to there. And I make sure to give them the link. Again, I'm trying to reduce your workload. If you tell students go to the Writing Center, the next email I'm gonna have is going to be, where's the Writing Center? How do I get there? Where's the link to the Writing Center? So I make sure to have all this on my copied Word document so that they can get straight to the, through my feedback, they can get straight to the Writing Center by clicking on the link. And then I'd say, make sure to let me know how your appointment went. The reason I do that, keep the dialogue open, right? Now they're accountable. I wanna know how your appointment went. I wanna know that you went. So go and come back and tell me. And I've opened up that dialogue. So then I make all this on a Word document, copy and paste it, edit it as I can. But again, remember I told you about recording. You can, in D2L, we're so lucky. We can record feedback, audio or video. So use your rubric to mark the content. But when you give that feedback, if you want to give it in video or oral, try to be positive. You don't need to say what the student didn't do. It's already in the rubric. They know that. Instead, try to be positive. Try to reinforce that effort because that's the behavior we want repeated. Learning is a process, right? It takes time. I researched, this is from Nevada University, I think. What are the positive results of increased transparency? Explaining the why to our students. One is an increase in academic confidence. Two, increase in employer valued skills, right? If I can't get my work done and I don't tell my boss, he's gonna be pretty upset. So it's important if I can't get my work done that I communicate with my boss. Same thing, this is what we're teaching our students. If you can't get your assignment done, please communicate with me. Tell me that you need an extension. Often people say, well, that doesn't happen in the real life. Come on, happens to me all the time where I can't get all my marking done. What do? The next day I go to class, I tell my students, I couldn't get my marking done. It'll be done tomorrow, right? That's what we do. I never get fired. So it is, you know, we are teaching our students, speak up, okay? You can't get this done? Fine, when will it be done? Let me know. And increase the sense of belonging, which is going to bring us back to what's really important to me, right? Teaching in an Indigenous way. Belonging is so important, and that's kind of the, you know, big goal of this lesson today. Many of our students don't feel like they belong in post-secondary institution for all the reasons that I've told you before, because often, you know, our teaching is directed to 9-to-5, traditional student, not the online student, not the people that have childcare issues, not the people that have learning disabilities. We have to change that. We have to challenge our thinking and make sure that all our students feel like they belong. This is called the circle of courage. And I talked about this in my 2-eyed presentation with Bruce. When students feel like they belong, that is when they can master the content. If they don't feel like they belong, there's no point throwing content at them. They're not gonna absorb it. So first we start with making sure students belong, then they master the content, then they go out in the world and get those decent jobs with the decent pay, which remember was part of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals. And then the best part of this, which I think is the best part of UDL, is the generosity part. Then they go off into the workplace and they, you know, act like a good human, right? They are generous in the way that they treat others. They also give people extensions. They're also flexible. They are also creative. They also have a growth mindset. Why? Because they learned that in school, because we taught them how to be a decent human being and explained to them how to manage, how we manage our workload, how they need to manage their workload. So start with that belonging. Our students can master the content, become independent, and then be generous, right? I just think that this is so important. some feedback that Nevada University collected from transparent designs from students. It's really important to listen to student voices. Students said, I knew the purpose of each assignment. I knew how my work would be evaluated because the why was explained to them. The rubric was given to them. I knew the steps required to complete my assignment. It was given to them in writing. Each assignment included detailed set of instructions for completing it in writing and also in video or maybe in audio. My instructor provided us with annotated examples of past student work so they could see what's possible. My instructor provided tools to assess the quality of my own work. Again, the rubric. As we're coming to an end, I just wanted to leave you with some advice about what I talked about today. So here you have a slide that says past, present, and future. As teachers, we often live in the future, right? Our goal is outcomes. We need students to meet outcomes. And so we're always looking at how are students going to meet our outcomes. And then we also live in the past. We're looking, and in the future, so we're worried about outcomes and we're worried about planning, right? We're always planning for the future. What's going to happen tomorrow? What's going to happen next week? What do my students have to do to meet their outcomes? And then we're thinking in the past because we're looking at what students achieved already. And sometimes we're like, oh, that student, not very good. I don't think they're going to pass. Or that student's great. And then we have really high expectations of them. We're really disappointed when they don't repeat those expectations. But my only advice to you is for tomorrow. And I know it's really important. We live in the future. We live in the past. But try living in the present for a minute. Go to your class tomorrow. And or not tomorrow, but on Tuesday, I guess. Or maybe you are going tomorrow. go to your class and try to be in the moment, right? Try to be in the moment. Try to spend that time having those conversations with their students. Find out where they're from. Find out what their barriers are. Set them up so they have community. And explain to them why they're doing things. These are my biggest resources, which I wanted to share with you. One of the resources that I love is called Think UDL Podcast. You can Google it. It's free. It has amazing speakers. One speaker I just listened to recently is Jodi Black. She's from Ontario. Maybe you know her. She has master classes for UDL. So listen to this podcast. If you don't like listening to this podcast, you're a reading person. They actually provide transcripts for all the presentations, which are 1 hour, the interviews, so you can listen. CAST.org, which I told you about, has a symposium every year, best PD I ever got, presented twice last year and this year. This year, the theme was listening to student voices. So I suggest you go on their website. They also have free stuff. Perspective Lives, College and Institutes Canada. Like I told you, I get a lot of my information from the US, but the best thing about Perspective Lives, which you can go to their website or, and all these presentations are on YouTube, is all the statistics are from Canada. They have guests from all Canadian institutions and all the statistics are Canadian. So might be helpful if you're doing some research. And then of course, I'm gonna plug in my TED Talk if you haven't seen it already, advocating for universal design. It's only 8 minutes. Before we go to questions, I just wanted to show you this picture. We have two people and one of them's carrying a jar that says happiness. And one person says, where did you find that? I've been searching for it everywhere. And the person holding the jar says, I created it myself because you can create your own happiness. You can make your job happy again, hopefully by trying some of the things I taught you today. And paying attention to your workload. Thank you so much for inviting me. And I'm sorry I went maybe a little close to the end, but we still have time for questions, I think, Jennifer.
Yes, so thank you so much, Jennifer. It's been such a wonderful session today. You know, your passion and your knowledge about human relationships and UDL So many wonderful little nuggets of wisdom. You know, things like I've got, you know, chicken scratch all over here, but, you know, considering recording your lectures, the frequency of assessments, the big question to extend or not to extend, yeah. right? So, and there's positive outcomes to extending deadlines. Yeah. So, you know, how the other great takeaway is how practicing UDL can actually reduce workload.
Yeah.
And my favorite, humanizing learning. So I think all of us, there's faculty in this group and there's support staff and admin. I think we can, you know, all use this in our personal and our professional lives. So before we run to, I know we're a little bit over, but I did really want to highlight this because this just shows what, a wonderful person, Jennifer is. She's going to be donating her honorarium to the Thousand Women Rising Fund, which if you get a chance, Google it. It provides financial support at Bow Valley College for the female students who are, you know, who might need a little support in their education. Yeah, so thank you, Jennifer. That's very generous. We appreciate that very much. Now, I know that we have about 30 seconds for any questions, but I know that this is so wonderful. I've heard you speak before. I wish you could just come back tomorrow, but yeah.
It might be anytime.
So we had some feedback in the chat. Elizabeth Brownlee loves your feedback idea. Jamie shared that you know how very generous of you. And I know that Dean Lessard, who is my fearless leader, just maybe wants to say a quick word to you. So thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you, Jennifer. Jennifer, very, very, very sincere, honest, open presentation.
Thank you.
Very appreciated. It's you know, there's different styles, and I really appreciate it. I think it came across very genuine today, and I think that's a very honest, honest assessment about things that we can do as educators in our classrooms today. I do have one question for you. So you talked about, because it's interesting, I started a talk with my other hat I wear is with the School Community Services, and I see Jennifer Dillon Pinto's on the line, and I have Emily on the line, and I think there's a couple other, Jamie Broderick. What we're doing this year is our project is that we're going to make sure that every one of our courses and every one of our assignments in those courses have rubrics. Then the secondary piece of our conversation that we've been weeding into for the 23-24 academic year will be the use of exemplars. And there's some concern, rightfully so, expressed by faculty along the lines of exemplars. And you talked about, you know, providing 5 or 6 different ones at a time and that you rotate through. And I think that's a really good practice. What has been your experience in sharing exemplars and then the students turn around and, for lack of a better word, replicating it almost like to the letter? Like, did you have a number of academic integrity violations as a result of sharing that? Because that was some of the concerns or dialogue that we had as a group around that is exemplars are great, we believe in them, but there was a sense that particularly with some of our international learners that if we say that's a good one and here's a good one and here's how it fits with our rubric, that we may get an influx in academic integrity violations. What's your experience been thus far with use of exemplars?
My experience has been the complete opposite. And maybe the reason is because I share the exemplars in class. So I really put them up in class. We talk about them. And then I say, you know, so obviously you can't copy this because we looked at it all together and it's going to be very obvious to me since, you know, we just looked at this. If you copy this, that I'm going to know exactly where it came from. So I'm kind of eliminating actually that situation by sharing the content with them and showing them that I'm very aware what's in these exemplars. I know them very well. I've been looking at them several times. If you copy any part of these, I will know instantly. And we often talk a lot about, we use Turnitin, which I'm sure you do as well. I show them how it works, and I show them how any work that's been submitted to Bow Valley College already is going to be picked up very easily by the system. And then I reinforce that they have extensions. So if you come into a problem where you can't get the work done, don't decide to plagiarize, but instead come to me and say, you know, I need an extension. So I'm reducing that stress and then really sharing all the information with them, the big why, right? Explaining all the why. So I feel like I'm eliminating all those situations where they might tend to feel like the only solution left is to commit academic dishonesty.
Thank you. I like the link to the extension piece too. That makes a lot of sense. I know that, you know, we've had some experience with our students using like software to use words that are very similar to what are, and I mean, you're nodding your head because I think it's a pretty much universal. So yeah. It's nice to hear because, you know, my background is public ed is where I started. So I was a teacher and a school principal before coming to the college, and use of exemplars was a big part of our instructional practice at the schools that I worked at. So thank you for sharing. And I know we've run over, but it has been a real pleasure. And I'll just extend Jennifer's thanks, my many thanks to you. I really enjoyed the authentic nature, genuine nature of your presentation, Jennifer. And like I said, the things that you shared may seem obvious to a lot of people, but it's good to hear them again and again and again, because they are best practices. And it is that easy to be that engaging with your students and understanding the differences in how students learn and how they demonstrate their learning. So thank you very, very much.
Yeah. And if I didn't answer your question, please write me. Feel free to write me.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Have a great end of your PD day.
Bye. Thanks, everyone. See you in the afternoon. We'll see you at just after lunch for Sarah Campbell. We'll be starting the welcome for the keynote address of Brent Edwards following lunch. So I look forward to seeing everybody there. And thank you, Jennifer Russo. Terrific presentation.